Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Thank you so much for taking time to sit down with me, Tom. Thrilled to have you here, and thank you for joining us on the Label Sessions podcast. Just to kick us off, just introduce yourself to our audience and share what perhaps you're best known for.
I'm a CMO. The last few years, I've been a fractional CMO. And I guess potentially the most formative experience of my career, I've been working at Red Bull International in the brand marketing team in Austria for 5 years. And then from there, I've moved into the Web3 space. So I'm trying to bring that level of kind of marketing excellence into Bitcoin, which is a big challenge to say the least.
We know you're somebody who's worked a lot with hypergrowth startups and through constant sort of changes within the market. And obviously, as you mentioned there, in the crypto and blockchain sort of space. So could you talk me through some of those practical challenges and strategies that are associated with bootstrapping, and especially in the context of navigating the crypto and blockchain industry?
One of the similarities, I think, that's maybe amplified by being in the Web3 blockchain space when it comes to hypergrowth tech is how quickly the market changes can impact, for example, your budgets or consumer sentiment. So something I've seen before in consumer tech is how quickly investment can dry up, how acquisition costs can change quite quickly on certain channels. But within blockchain, that's really amplified. So because there's so much in terms of investment and also user engagement is driven by this kind of greed and fear ratio, you can really see that budgets can be cut 10 times faster in Web3, and also engagement can completely drop off a cliff. Because users are incentivized so effectively in Web3 for their engagement, when they see that there's no money in the market, you see a real dip in engagement. So the way that it affects the market is really very reactive. You need to make sure that your budget is being spent effectively, but also that you're not contractually bound to anything that's going to put you in trouble if the market does change or if there's a correction. That's quite hard to do because a lot of the decent vendors are going to want to tie you to the longer contracts. And so there's always competition when the market is running for those people that you know can deliver value. So it's a real balancing act of having confidence in the market, but also mitigating that risk because things always change and it's incredibly cyclical.
That's interesting. And how do you go about striking a balance between engineering early traction in these contracts, achieving a product market fit?
Especially in the Web3 space, achieving early traction, I think, is potentially very easy, or at least very easy to show. Actually, sustaining it is the real challenge. So a lot of projects choose to fake it till they make it. So they might use airdrops or contests in order to bring people to a project. What we're seeing more and more is people with a better understanding of customer lifetime value, retention, and actually building a community of people who are more likely to use your product and then to refer people later on. There is a place for both of these approaches, though, because it's still important to have that social proof, to have that early engagement, because it will help you later on to then bring the right customers on. So finding the balance between the two is the real challenge. But because there are incentives at play when it comes to using tokens and NFTs in the Web3 space, it does tend to bring a lot of value-seeking behaviors from people. So the challenge is to find ways to make sure that the incentives you provide for either engagement or early advocacy predetermine for your actual customers. So not incentivizing people with things like tokens or NFTs, but with experiences or access that are only important for people who are, you know, power users for your product.
And then going from that sort of early traction, there's a lot of talk around this specific sort of industry is going around is around going viral to pick up that initial growth and then going from there. And what sort of advice would you give for startups who are regarding the finding the right audience and create between creating noise and attracting like a genuinely interested audience, not just a sort of initial flash in the pan?
It's always appealing, especially for people outside of marketing or outside of strategic marketing, to look at going viral, creating a lot of noise, and looking at those kind of top of the funnel metrics. I think anyone who's had to rationalize a budget or look at the long-term performance of your marketing spend knows that you need to be looking at optimizing on customer lifetime value. I think there's a really pertinent example of this at the moment, which is, I don't know if you saw the No Smoke campaign with Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
You see this?
Yeah.
I think the CMO just got fired because even though it went viral, this awareness didn't convert into any customers. So it was their biggest campaign, had the biggest awareness, and it had the least results. And I think that kind of exemplifies the challenge of marketing. If people are putting pressure on you to create waves, but not think about what the actual outcome is. And that's a really fast turnaround. It wasn't very long ago that everyone was talking about that as a great campaign. But ultimately, if it makes noise but without any outcome, then it's a waste of time.
And then pivoting from that to cultivating a sort of culture of testing and learning, how do you approach this within the tech and product-driven teams that you've worked with or work with now?
One of the most useful ways of thinking about how to kind of collect the different hypotheses to test when it comes to growth experiments is to make sure that it's really democratized outside of marketing, outside of growth, even outside of product, just to make sure that you're not already starting too narrow on your expectations. So my work experience and my education mean that I'm automatically going to be biased towards certain activities that I know have worked for me in the past. And that automatically means I'm missing so many opportunities, especially when it comes to the areas that I'm weaker in. Be it something around product marketing or specific parts of marketing that I'm not such an expert in. And so by including people with varying levels of experience, so sometimes it's particularly useful to have people with a certain level of naivety suggesting things, because that naivety is really reassessing something on a very simple basis. And when you look at things from the first time, you know, there are less of those biases involved. And then when you've collected all of these potential ideas, then there are a couple of simple frameworks that you can use to prioritize, which makes sense in terms of impact, ease. There's, what is it, PIES and BRASS framework, I think, are the two main ones that you would use. And it's a very effective way of making sure that you collect all of the potential inspiration from within the business. And then only after you've collected that and you've not said no to anybody, then you can identify those that are most likely to impact the business in a way that is kind of measurable, repeatable. And the challenge is being able to keep this process and actually create this kind of growth mindset within the business. But in a consumer tech business where you've got a product team, you've got growth, those things tend to be relatively easy to do because it ties in with what people with people's objectives for improving the product, improving user experience, improving acquisition. But obviously, it's difficult. It shouldn't be owned by any one team. It needs to be nebulous and outside of those teams, I think. Even people within, finance and those kind of services have got some interesting ideas to share. I wouldn't dissuade anybody from putting those kind of things forward. And Slack is a very useful tool for being able to kind of collect those things across the organization.
And then going from that almost into sort of a realm of experimentation, how do you think experimentation plays into you achieving sustained growth?
I think one of the main opportunities of experimentation is that it helps you to be adaptable to the changing market. The kind of playbook that a lot of marketers will use to approach the business in normal market conditions are going to be the same generally. Within each channel, you'll be looking to continuously improve. You'll be looking to improve your targeting, your positioning, your messaging. You might even then consider looking at different personas or creating new products. But ultimately, you're not going to see exponential growth once you've got those foundations in place from that kind of strategy. You really need to be looking at looking at bringing in tactics from outside of that kind of bread and butter foundational marketing in order to see real growth. And I think, so using a growth kind of mindset is more likely to expose you to an idea that opens up a huge market opportunity that's either untapped or is something that you can test whether there is traction, whether your product actually serves that need, and whether there is enough intent or even purchasing power for it.
You've navigated quite a lot of different size budgets. And how do you advise startups for maximizing those resources, whether it's time or people or money? And what lessons have you learned from your experiences in more particularly resource-constrained environments?
Having experience with different size budgets is super interesting. And at Red Bull, for example, I was working in marketing effectiveness and looking at the effectiveness of product launches at a time where we were spending billions of euros on marketing a year. And this was incredibly interesting to have that massive amount of data to see what was happening across markets and across products. Obviously, I didn't have control of that budget, but it was still interesting to understand the data behind that. And then moving into startups at different stages, you're dealing with some big and growing and changing budgets, which is the real challenge when they're changing quickly. But I would say that the same thing that's true across startups, early stage businesses, and in blockchain is to make sure that the foundational places are there before spending too much money on those experiments. Until the website is converting properly, until you've got a blog that's operating or your socials are something that you can be proud of, you've got decent levels of engagement, it's probably counterproductive to be spending too much time thinking about growth experiments until you found that baseline, until you understand what your normal kind of incremental level of growth is, as well as if you're running experiments and people drop out of an ad and they come back to your website. If your website isn't already optimized, you're not taking advantage of that leakage. So the advice is always kind of the same, is that make sure that the foundations are correct and then prioritize the channels where you can actually attribute your activity and your dollar spend at those early stages. The challenge with doing that too long term is you need to consider the role of brand building, brand versus performance, and that's always a challenge, especially if budgets are tight. Equally, if you focus on those channels where you can easily attribute, there's going to be a bias towards those channels that you attribute better. It doesn't necessarily mean that they perform better. It just means that you can measure them better. And so you need to keep that in mind when you're considering how to split that budget across channels. So initially, it tends to be that you need to focus very much on maybe even one paid channel initially to get a read, so you've got enough data. But very quickly, it makes sense to test that across some other channels and also evaluate the way that you're measuring that data, the way that you're evaluating it, because there's always a bias towards the things that can be known and understood. But that's not necessarily the driver of long-term growth. And when it comes to acquisition, obviously people are always look towards paid social, paid search, and those are very important channels, but sometimes they forget that the role of brand is baked into that. Building trust is always going to benefit your ability to capture people, to acquire them, to get them to click through, to get them to sign up, to encourage them to be a customer. And so it shouldn't be brand versus paid. It should be making sure that the brand is already to a certain level before spending that money on that page. And you can't attribute between those two activities, but it's very easy to look at them as two separate silos when they're not.
But going into more of the present day, obviously working in the crypto space, and you work directly with investors to evaluate pitch decks for sort of seed investments, that sort of thing. And I'd love for you to go into a little bit of the insights into the challenges of raising funds in an industry like crypto compared to more traditional sectors.
Similar to what we were saying before with the sentiment in the market, I think it's a very similar trend when it comes to how easy it can be to raise in TradFi and in Web3. It's very much based on the conditions. Sometimes a few years ago, it was particularly easy to raise money. It was everybody was looking for somewhere to invest their money, especially into consumer tech. Then there was a massive run for people looking, even moving their money into the Web3 space. More recently, the last year, I think it's been very difficult for in tech and in Web3 for anybody to raise any money. But at least it signposts to the market or to the project what you need to be doing in that time, which is focusing on building the product, building your network, and showing that you can manage your budget, extend your runway as far as possible. And then if you get through that kind of winter, it shows to the investors when their appetite for investment has increased that one, you know the importance of prioritizing what's going to derive most value for the business, and shows that you've got some kind of understanding of financial management, which is so important if they are going to invest in your business. I think a lot of businesses continue to try and raise even though the conditions weren't good, whereas trying to reduce their costs, trying to find an additional revenue stream, looking for partnership opportunities so that they can monetize their own community or share costs or co-market with other projects, for example, is potentially a far. I mean, obviously, it's easy to post-rationalize this. No one knew how long the conditions would be like that. But those people that get the timing right are always the winners. The timing is always more important than anything else.
And then you're someone who regularly sort of mentors and provides feedback on pitch decks. What are the key elements that you look for that makes a compelling, especially a sector known for its innovation and rapid sort of evolution? Is there like a magic spark that you keep a lookout for?
It kind of depends with which hat we're looking at the deck for. So when I was working for a crypto fund, the value for us was in one, understanding the value of the business, but also the value that we could offer them, understanding if there's a gap in their expertise that can be filled specifically by us. Then it's not only an investment, it's a good partnership where we know that we can develop that business together. Sometimes in decks, the kind of ask is the difficult thing. People struggle with understanding what it is they're looking for in terms of the investment and the support they're looking for. It's useful if people are particularly specific on that, because you want your lead investor to be one that actually is able to provide everything that you're looking for. Sometimes it's opening doors to other investors. Some people are just looking for cash. Some people are looking for validation. And I think people, because of ego, people get difficult when it's easy for them to talk about themselves and the product, but maybe it's harder for them to talk about what it is specifically that they need. And they don't want to exclude some potential offers. But I think being more specific and then matching that to the kind of investor that you're talking to is always going to be advantageous. The same way that if you're applying for a job, you customize your cover letter and your CV to who you're talking to. I would always show that your ask is matched with what the capabilities of the investor are. I think that's most. I think a lot of the decks seem to be. There's been so much focus on pitch decks over the last few years because of the kind of the LinkedIn thought leadership VC pitch guy. That I think there's one. It means that I think the quality is overall improved dramatically. But two, they've almost become quite generic as well. I think this is also a little bit down to Canva. It makes it easier for people to make things that look pretty. But there, more and more often you look at a deck, but it just doesn't light you on fire, perhaps. So the why should I care, or why is now the perfect time for this? And that's the hard piece to put together quite often.
That's brilliant. And that brings us to the end of our main body of questions. I have to say that you passed with flying colors.
Yes.
So what we do next, our sort of tradition is we do a little bit of a quick five questions, so a little bit more fun or dread, depending on how you look at these. And so we'll kick this one with the first one. So even if you're not a particularly great cook, because I know I'm not, what's your sort of signature dish that you use to impress friends or family?
I love to cook, actually. I've been outside of the UK for a while, so I would always come back to a roast dinner probably.
In another life, what would your career be?
I wouldn't mind being a footballer, but in another life, I might have the skills to actually achieve that. But yeah, I can't think of another career with a commercial career that particularly makes sense. But I'd love to be a football player. I mean, I flirted with working in the commercial side of football clubs is fun. I kind of like the way that it feels like a bit more of a gamble in that the what they do on the pitch actually really directly impacts the effectiveness of your marketing or your merch sales, which is appealing and terrifying at the same time. And as a Crystal Palace fan, I think I don't know whether I want to fully attach my personal life and my professional life to that one club. Might be too much turmoil.
What was the first work thing that you were really proud of?
The first thing that comes to mind immediately, I guess, would be when I was at university, I did a sandwich year. So I worked at Xerox for a year, which was a very big, safe kind of corporate environment for marketing. I was working in the supplies team, so it was paper, essentially. I guess that predates Dunder Mifflin in the office, but it definitely wasn't quite like that. I think in that first kind of professional corporate experience, I was invited to go to an event in Cologne called Drupa, which they all humorously call the Olympics of printing, because I think it's every 4 years, which is so funny. But being able to go to this event and actually be invited into the world of these people that really care very deeply about the tech and the experience and, you know, the way that these incredibly expensive, you know, $1 million printers can provide all of these solutions for, you know, big businesses or multiple businesses. It was quite nice to be invited to see their world or, you know, the things that were particularly important to them, as well as it was my first kind of business trip, which is always really a nice feeling as a young business person.
You've given a lot of great advice this podcast. So what is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given yourself?
One of the best pieces of advice I think I potentially got when I was at Red Bull was to stay close to the core of the business or the part of the business that is driving the revenue. And it doesn't necessarily matter what business you're in, but being close to where the things matter, where people are investing their money, where people are scrutinizing it, is potentially the most interesting part of the business. It's if you're very lucky and you move into maybe a new business unit or a new product extension, there's obviously there's a risk there, but there's massive opportunity for growth, and you can be part of a bigger part. I think maybe at Red Bull it was particularly useful to stay close to the can. There were so many other interesting parts of the business. But the can business, I think, is really what it all comes down to. It's about driving people back to the can. And ultimately, it's the same as what I was saying before. We're not focusing on awareness. We want to focus on consumption, right? We want to focus on the thing that drives the revenue. Otherwise, and that's kind of what separates somebody from being from being a marketer and from being a strategic marketer, is making sure that your activities are actually showing up positively somewhere on the finances, you know, making sure that your impact is net positive when people are evaluating the business, when they want to cut budgets, when they want to increase salaries, for example. And you want to make sure that you're close to providing that tangible business impact. I think that's a good way to think about any business, to be honest, and any activity that you engage with.
And then that brings us to our last question. It's a question we ask everyone, some of these quick fire questions. On a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you, Tom? 10 being the weirdest and 1 being the least.
It's the 8, probably.
8?
I'd say solid, isn't it? It's pretty high. I think people that know me might say I'm underdoing it.
That's a great space to leave it. So thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me, Tom. Really appreciate it. It's been a really fascinating sort of insight, and hope to speak to you again soon.
Perfect. Thanks, Josh.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.